Why the UFOs had so much of an interest in these old warships became a somewhat baffling problem for me at the time, he says. Determined to learn more, Marius approached two tribal chiefs for further information about the dragon snake. My suspicions were right, the chiefs knew a lot about it. One of the chief's brothers had been killed by it when he was only a little boy. They told me several stories of deaths and abductions, all of which confirmed to me that these UFOs are definitely not friendly. They may be friendly in other places in the world, but certainly not here. The tribal chiefs pointed Marius in the direction of the dragon snake's house, which they said lay in an unnamed mountain, which for convenience Marius named Mount Dragon, part of the mountain range which includes Mount Poporia, about 8 kilometers inland. They told me of a big waterfall high up in the mountain with a lake beneath, into which the water falls. Inside that lake is where the dragon snake lives. A further study of Mount Dragon revealed that there is a small lake in the mountain that is the beginning of a river. What was at the bottom of this waterfall lake, and how many UFOs were there? I had to stop speculating on answers to these questions, as all of this was starting to sound a lot like a science fiction movie. One morning shortly afterward, Joseph informed Marius that a fisherman he knew had been taken to hospital with burns to most of his body sustained from a UFO two nights previously. The two visited the injured man. He was covered in bandages from head to toe, said Marius, and was in a great deal of pain, but doped up with pethidine. Joseph began to speak to him in the Guadalcan language to try and find out exactly what had happened to him. He had been out fishing in his fiberglass boat at about 3 a.m. when he saw the dragon snake flying along, and started flashing his torch at it. That was when it flew over to him in an instant and hovered overhead. Panicking, he started the motor and took off to get away from the dragon snake, but it followed him as he zigzagged his way back to shore. It was during this short pursuit to the beach that it fired some form of light at him, but it only partially hit him. A later inspection of his 19-foot boat showed traces of scorching upon some of the boat's interior paint. He said that when he drove his boat up the beach and ran into the bush, the dragon snake followed him to where he was hiding behind a tree and hovered above. When he moved around to the other side of the tree, it also went around to the other side. It was then that he literally got down on his knees and prayed to God with his hands clasped in front of him. With that, the dragon snake moved on. After that, he stumbled his way back to his village and was taken to hospital. It was an incredible story, but true, Marius stresses. He definitely had no reason to be lying. These kinds of UFO encounters have happened on numerous occasions over the past century, but, strangely enough, the Solomons being the way they are, reports have not been taken seriously. In discussions about these aliens with his father-in-law John, Marius explained how some white men believe they are about 4 feet tall with a large head, big eyes, 4 fingers, and so on. John said there was a book in the Solomon Islands Cultural Museum with pictures describing just this sort of being. They decided to visit the museum. There it was, said Marius. This 15-page book had 14 detailed hand-drawn sketches of aliens just like the ones we are all used to seeing on television. An islander had compiled this short collection of drawings for the museum from different eyewitness accounts. What I wanted to know was, how could the Solomon Islanders know anything about these kinds of aliens, when 99.99% of them had never had any significant type of exposure to white man's media? Most of the old tribal people still thought that the stars were caused by pinpricks in the sky and that the earth was flat. Further experiences, Marius pondered on the possible consequences of pursuing the matter any further. I had initially gone out to the Solomons to enjoy an early, youthful retirement and certainly had not expected to be chasing UFOs, he explains. But as a former military man, I couldn't stop thinking about the fact that this UFO was continually going near ships that had been involved in a great battle where thousands of men had lost their lives in the cause of freedom. It seemed as if this UFO was robbing graves. This weighed heavily on my mind for weeks. One night while fishing, Marius watched the UFO submerge near the wreck of the USS Chicago 1 and then resurface, shining more brightly. As he peered through his binoculars, he noticed a ship heading in his direction. From the trigonometric perspective, the UFO couldn't see the ship because of the point that was shielding its view, he assumed. However, I had both the UFO and the ship in my field of view. After about 30 seconds, when the UFO did see the ship, it instantly vanished, as if it had turned off its lights. I took my binoculars from my eyes. I was not sure if the craft had instantly accelerated or had somehow cloaked itself. Yet it seemed that the UFO didn't mind the indigenous people seeing it, but it did mind when someone saw it who would possibly know of its real identity. Marius and Joseph planned an expedition to Mount Dragon, having worked out that the dragon snake most likely would travel to and from its base via a 5-kilometer-long valley that runs in a northward direction past Mount Dragon. After searching the area for a suitable position, Marius reports, "We chose an accessible 800-foot mountain that had all the requirements we needed." The following day, the men gathered all the equipment they needed, including Marius's 30-shot 7.62mm gun and a shotgun. "In the event of an attack by wild pigs, we knew that the UFO had the habit of appearing at around 10 p.m. or 3 a.m. After parking their car in the bush, they climbed to the top of the mountain with the aid of torchlights. This gave them a commanding 270-degree view. With a clear view of the sea to the left of us and the valley's entrance to the right, there was no way that we were going to miss seeing the UFO when it made its appearance, and we didn't. Having sat up half the night, watching and waiting and having a few beers to pass the time, at 2:35 a.m. we saw the first glimmer of the UFO's light leaving the valley's entrance. There was an air of excitement. While training my binoculars on the UFO, I noticed that it was traveling toward our direction at a fair rate of speed, which we estimated later to be about 100 knots. We had been watching it approach us for close on a minute when it came past at an estimated height of 300 feet, half a kilometer away. No sooner had this UFO passed by than it took an instantaneous 45-degree turn to the left and then accelerated away at phenomenal speed. And we watched the UFO's light diminishing over the horizon within seconds, while still traveling at near sea level. Marius determined to make an expedition up the valley sometime to film the UFO. But he only had a Kodak Instamatic, which was of no use at night, and video cameras were neither cheap to buy nor available to borrow from anyone he knew. Weeks went by, and the craft continued to appear regularly. One morning at 3 a.m. a couple of weeks later, Marius reports, "Joseph and I were on the grass outside the house, husking coconuts around a fire, when we noticed the UFO. We observed that it was slowly moving in our direction. It started to get closer and closer, and it seemed to us that if it continued on the path it was on, it would overfly us. As it came progressively even closer, we started to move to the door of the house. Both Joseph and I were standing at the door when it flew over the nearby trees and over the top of the house. The brilliance of its white light radiated the whole area as if we were standing amidst the light of a dozen arc welders at once. This was the first time that I could clearly see the vehicle's sphere, shape, with my naked eye. It made no noise as it eerily passed over us. In fact, at the time we made audible comments to each other about what was happening. After it went by, we both ran out to see it disappearing over the trees further on." Joseph had experienced this sort of thing before, but I hadn't. Marius became partly overcome by a feeling of helplessness and inadequacy around that time, due to his constantly questioning the reality of it all. Malata bases, in 1996, 1997, and 2002, Marius made further research trips to the island of Malata, which is separated from Guadalcanal by the indispensable strait. According to members of his wife's family, NASA first made contact with the occupants of a subterranean alien base in central East Malata in 1961. This is how they began to gain what partial technology they have today, he claims. It was through blackmail. This happened because when the great, British, geologist Mr. Groffer was doing his few expeditions in the area in between 1958 and 1960, He saw these UFOs, then reported back to the UK, the ruling colonial power at the time, about them. Apparently, in 1961, a white man who claimed to be from NASA came to that part of the island and asked for assistance from my wife's relatives to take him to the UFO subterranean base entrances, which they did. I am the only white man ever to have married a woman from the Cuyo, who live in that area. This NASA guy was gone a week and then returned, asking my wife's relatives for further assistance to take him back to these places. There is a 50-meter diameter bottomless circular reef in amongst the surrounding 10-meter deep coral reef a few miles north of Koi Island, on the border of the Cuyo and Quirai tribes, and south of Namo Rea in central East Malaita. Singalangi Harbour is slightly further south. UFOs can be seen going in and out of that reef virtually every night. On mainland Malaita, about 3 to 4 miles directly inland from that circular reef entrance, is a lake which has two connected entrances, exits. When the boys are out fishing at night, they see the UFOs going in one entrance and coming out the other. A UFO coming out of this lake at dusk incinerated my good friend's grandfather, and everyone in the area knows about it. The aliens have instilled fear in these people for generations, and many people have gone missing. In the Cuyo and Quirai areas, there are three entrances in their jungle mountains that I know of where these balls of light type UFO vehicles can be seen entering and exiting. It is my belief that these entrances are not individual bases but are all connected, making up one big UFO base under the island. I may be wrong, but I also believe that one of the many reasons why they are here is that, for reasons of their own, they are mining a very rare type of gemstone under this kimberlite rock volcanic island. The gemstones that my wife's relatives possess have a far higher specific gravity than that of diamonds, and a refractive index such that when you put the stone in light, you see your mirror image in the center of the stone. I once had a 32.4 carat ET stone with these characteristics. There are some old folklore stories supporting the interest in these unique stones. Furthermore, as there are many remnants of the Ramo civilization that can be found on top of the island and the aliens underneath, there is every chance there is a connection. And that goes for on Guadalcanal, too. Marius also describes a waterfall lake UFO base in South Malaita where he has also witnessed activity. This base, he says, is located some 3 kilometers from Afiu, the main town. About a kilometer up the jungle mountain is their base entrance, he asserts, where they can be seen entering and exiting nearly every night, and also brazenly and casually flying along the passage. Many Solomon Islanders have told me of flat stingray-type UFOs too, with big round lights underneath them that hum as they go along. They sometimes see them flying low over the jungle and surfacing out of the sea near where they are fishing. The UFOs have landed near villages, and, white or black, people who get out of them have strange grey uniforms, not seen anywhere else in the world. You can make your own deductions there. If there were ever a place that one could call UFO headquarters, it would have to be Central Malaita, mind you. These are the only ones I know of. Goodness knows what else there is in the rest of the Solomon Islands. 3 and, I dare say, in the rest of our planet. 4. The Enchanted Isle. In the U.S. Commonwealth of Puerto Rico, the so-called Enchanted Isle sightings of alien craft and their occupants are commonplace. Having made 7 research trips there, I formed the unequivocal conviction, in company with leading investigator Jorge Martin and others, that the island and its surrounding waters are used as an alien base. Since I have published numerous reports of encounters in previous books, I shall restrict the information in this chapter to some important and more recent further events, mostly from 2005 to 2010. Around midnight on May 15, 2005, a large triangular craft was reported by a number of witnesses in San Juan. One of the witnesses, Wilfredo, was driving near Luis Muñoz Marin International Airport where he worked. I was in the town of Carolina near the Los Angeles development, on an avenue exactly facing the airport. He told researchers Willie Durand Urbina and Jose A. Martinez Echevarria. Then I saw a glow that came from behind a hill. That's when I heard dogs barking and birds singing, as if desperate. I was frightened. Then, when I looked behind me, I saw a very large glow. But I couldn't see the craft because I was inside the van. I pulled the van over and got out. That's when I saw an immense triangular object. I can't give you the exact measurements, but I can tell you, and compare it, to the size of a ballpark, or two enormous ballparks. It was going very slowly and passed directly over me. There was no sound, just a light coming out of the middle. It seemed that the light emitted some sort of heat. It made no noise whatsoever and was going slowly, very slowly, and that's when the van's engine and lights went out. I took my camera phone and tried to take photos of the object, but I had to remove the filter to lower the light intensity, because it couldn't be seen in the photos I had taken. That's how I managed to photograph the craft. Then I took another photo from inside my vehicle. And that's strange, because nothing electrical worked, yet my cell phone worked. I tried to turn the engine over, but nothing. It's as if they wanted me to take a picture. The street lights went out as it flew overhead, flying over the parking lot and away. I also found it strange that the airport lights also went out. And the clouds were lit up by the object as it departed. 2 weeks after the encounter, Wilfredo noticed that the paint on his van began to show little spots, blood red or mud colored, throughout the entire vehicle, which could not be removed. Another 2 weeks later he became ill. "I've never been so sick," he said. "I'm a very healthy person." I don't know if it had anything to do with the experience. Blood tests proved negative. Shortly after, Wilfredo's car was stolen. That happened after I spoke to a female co-worker who claimed to have been abducted by aliens. She told me about her experiences, and 2 days later I felt as though I was being watched. 5. Since early 2007, Wilfredo observed the same, or similar, huge craft over the airport control tower on many occasions, typically between 2020 and 2030. This time using the pseudonym Mr. Rodriguez, owing to his work at the airport, he decided to board a scheduled American Eagle flight departing at 2030 for Vieques, an island off the east coast of Puerto Rico, together with a skeptical friend, to see the object more closely and gain the support of another witness. As Lucy Guzman reports, Rodriguez says that as the American Eagle flight gained altitude, it was necessary to look toward route number 3, as this was where the light appears to emerge from, toward the beach area. The UFO approached the plane sufficiently for him to realize that it was larger than the airliner. It then made a U-turn, heading toward Fajardo, and then Vieques, as though heading for the nearby islands. He says that he alerted all of the passengers and asked the co-pilot about the strange light, who replied, in English, "Forget about it," which led Rodriguez to believe that pilots are forbidden to discuss what is going on, or else did not want to alarm them. The same event happened on the return trip from Vieques to San Juan. Repeated encounters. In 2005, Maria M. Rivera and her family began to experience a series of alarming encounters with alien beings in Aguada, northwest Puerto Rico. At about 3 o'clock on November 10, Maria and her daughter heard a weird humming sound, like a hurricane wind, going by the house. The sound was so strange that it penetrated our ears, the report she sent me begins. When my daughter Bobby and I looked outside, we observed what appeared to be a disc-shaped object moving westward toward the rear of the house where an enormous rainforest and a huge antenna are located, and which leads all the way to the Atlantic Ocean. The disc was silver in color with a row of windows around it and had a greenish haze or aura covering the craft. All the windows appeared to be a darker greenish color. The craft appeared to be descending as though it was about to land somewhere behind the house. We lived in Brooklyn, New York, near Kennedy Airport for over 20 years, so I know what we have seen, and the sounds it made were very unusual, something we've never heard and seen before. After that, my daughter and I heard the same sound at least twice a week. On April 28, 2006, at about 3 o'clock, Maria again heard the same sound. 10 or 15 minutes later, I heard my dog Dora barking continuously in the backyard. When I went to investigate, Turning on the backyard light, I observed my dog lying on her back with her four legs up, apparently unconscious. The dog was chained to a metal pole next to the back fence which separates my property from the rainforest in the back, owned by the US government. I called her name, but she did not respond. When I lifted my eyes and looked at the fence, about 25 feet from where I was standing, I observed two creatures standing close to and behind the chain link fence, looking at me. One of the aliens was about 3 feet from the dog, and about 5 feet from the other. They were about 3.5 feet tall, with a large oval head and big black slanted eyes. They had pale grayish skin, a barely visible slit for a mouth, and two little holes for a nose. They also had very skinny arms and seemed not to have any clothes on. Their legs were not showing because under the fence was a cinder block wall, about 1.5 feet high. I could only see them from the waist up. Maria's sketch appears on the next page. The aliens were staring at me and I was staring at them. I think that they were reading my mind when I said mentally, "I'm going to wake up my husband, Nelson," because when I left the window and walked through the hallway leading through to the bedrooms to wake him up, they detoured me to the other bedroom to wake up my 17-year-old daughter instead. I woke her up and both of us went to the dining room window where we observed the creatures still standing in the same place. Again, they stared at us and we stared straight into their large black eyes for a while. My daughter said to me, "Mommy, I'm going back to bed because I'm scared, and I won't be able to sleep." I then followed her to the bedroom because she was afraid to go by herself. Approximately 10 minutes later, I returned to the dining room window, and the aliens were still in the same location. While staring straight into their black eyes, the one closest to the dog was telling me in my mind to open the door leading to the backyard. I said in my mind, "I'm not going to open the door." He demanded telepathically, "You're going to open the door." I then felt myself moving toward the door and was getting drowsy. I don't remember what happened after that. I woke up in my bed, and asked my daughter if she had seen the same thing, in case I was imagining things. She described the incident and the creatures in the same way and the manner I described them. We then told my husband, who slept in a separate bedroom facing the backyard, because my daughter was afraid to sleep by herself, so I had to sleep with her. Nelson confirmed having heard the dog barking furiously in the direction of the rainforest at about 3 o'clock. He looked outside without getting out of bed and assumed she was barking at a cat, and did not look in the direction of the rainforest and fence. He then fell back to sleep. What concerns me the most, Maria stressed to me, is that my husband informed me that he discovered the back door open when he got up at about 8 o'clock in the morning, but did not know what had happened. My daughter informed me she opened her eyes about 5 o'clock in the morning and did not find me next to her in bed. She thought I was in the bathroom or somewhere around the house and went back to sleep. And the dog did not want to eat or drink anything for days and was lying down, apparently sick. We did take Dora to the vet, but did not dare to mention that some aliens were seen next her. She was just given an antibiotic injection. On May 1, 2006, at about 0:50, while sitting in the living room talking on the phone, Maria noticed a large bright light moving through the woods. The light was so bright that it illuminated the inside of the house. I informed my husband and we immediately closed all the louver windows in the kitchen and dining room. I became hysterical and began to cry because I thought they were after me, and my husband had to calm me down. At approximately 2 a.m. the same night, I heard the same sound again over the house, like something hitting the flat concrete roof, which shook the house as if something had landed there. We were afraid, but did not call the police for fear of being ridiculed. It was such a terrifying experience that we didn't even consider going outside to check it out. Instead, the three of us huddled in one bed. Could it be possible that I did open the backyard door and was abducted by aliens? I don't know. But I have dotted puncture marks on my left hand, in a circular pattern, and had a slight burning pain which gradually diminished as time went by. A week or so later, Maria and her family went to visit the Mayor of Aguada, Luis A. Echevarria, at City Hall, but he was unavailable. Instead, they notified Martin Conception of Puerto Rico's Civil Defense Agency and handed him their written testimony. He said he would investigate and asked the municipal police to patrol the area, copying in the mayor. Nothing more was heard. On May 11, Maria and Nelson were interviewed on Channel 5, but the interviewer tried to debunk their experiences, citing Puerto Rican superstitions and hoaxed claims. "My husband and I were so upset," said Maria. "We told him that we are honest people, not superstitious, and just because someone lied, it does not mean that we are liars. We even sent emails to several Puerto Rican UFO investigative organizations, but they did not email us back. We did not know who to turn to since we were not getting help from anyone here on the island. So my husband and I started sending emails to the US mainland and to other countries to see whether someone or some organization would help us." Further incidents. Maria compiled a list of further incidents, which I summarize as follows. June 5, 2006, car. 3 o'clock, after watching television, Maria went to get a glass of milk before retiring for the night. As she walked through the living room on her way to the bedroom, she observed a creature peeping through the glass pane window on the main entrance door. She surmised that he was standing on top of a patio chair, assuming it was the same height as the previous creatures. She also said it scared her as it looked older, meaner, with a sinister look on its face. She woke her husband, who grabbed a machete and went out on the balcony. But the creature had disappeared. October 22, 2006, car. 2300 hours, a blackout affected Aguada for 3 hours. At about midnight, Maria awoke her husband so he could hear a weird humming sound emanating from behind the house in the rainforest. February 25, 2007, car. 4 o'clock, Maria observed a disc-shaped craft, similar to the one she had seen before, from her bedroom window. About 30 feet in diameter, it was hovering motionless some 130 feet from the house and the same distance from the ground. She was able to observe aliens, who in turn were observing her through viewing ports, silhouetted against a bright greenish-blue background. No sounds could be detected. By the time she had woken her husband, who picked up a camcorder, the craft had gone. May 21, 2007, car. 1 o'clock, Maria's daughter Barbie was talking on her cell phone in the living room when she suddenly heard the humming sound again and a greenish-blue light flashed through all the windows, flashing in sequence from the front to the back windows. June 2, 2007, car. 2 o'clock, Maria's 21-year-old son, Jonathan, who had come to visit from New York, noticed a very bright beam of green light shining through the windows in his bedroom. He was so frightened, reports Maria, that after the light vanished he hysterically ran upstairs in his pajamas to inform us. August 14, 2007, early in the morning, the family's dog Dora was nowhere to be found. A search all over the neighborhood proved fruitless. "I do not know if it had something to do with those aliens," said Maria, "but after what happened to me and my family in that house, anything is possible." After the disappearance of Dora, the family moved to another house in Aguada, further from the beach and the rainforest. To no avail. November 3, 2007, car. 2 o'clock, Maria's most traumatic experience occurred just prior to falling asleep, when she saw a small bluish-green neon light, about the size of a penny, coming from the window and moving round the bedroom in the dark. Maria became paralyzed. "Suddenly my bed was being surrounded by those creatures. Obviously, I was made unconscious because when I opened my eyes I found myself naked, in a different, cold room, and lying face up on a very cold stainless steel platform. This platform," Maria continued, "seemed to be floating on the air without legs or anything supporting it. It was narrow enough that my arms hung over the sides. Still feeling paralyzed but conscious, they commenced injecting me with a long needle or something. I begged them with my thoughts to please not do it, but they ignored me. I also felt that they put something metallic, like a round suction cap about 5 inches in diameter, on the right side of my abdomen. It felt as if my flesh was being stretched and my inside was being sucked out like a powerful vacuum. I was in excruciating pain when they did that, but I was unable to scream or move. About five or six creatures surrounded the platform, one being taller than the others, and the rest were the short greys I previously saw in my backyard.